Gerrit,
which in the American vernacular is a way of saying Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Yay!
I guess actually that's Gaelic.
It just means hello. I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren, and we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com. Today we're covering a few modern gems of Irish cinema. This Thursday will be St. Paddy's Day, but as little as I know about Ireland, I do know that St. Paddy's Day is less about Irish culture than it is an American excuse to get drunk in the streets.
Well, yeah, I mean, like we were talking about earlier, well, earlier at our desks, not earlier on this show, but it's an interesting kind of thing that they say that there's more people who claim Irish heritage in the United States than people in Ireland. So that's kind of a fun fact.
So as a kid growing up in the States, I feel we never really got an accurate picture of Ireland. Outside of bad stereotypes, leprechauns or yetis, we might have heard some rumblings about terrorism and bombings or studied U2 lyrics that talked about the Troubles.
Sure, sure.
Going into this podcast, I knew pretty little about the culture aside from occasional news stories, and I still can't say I understand it really. I know Ireland is a very Catholic country.
Yes.
The South is, at least the North, is generally Protestant, but culturally religious to the point where getting a divorce only became legal in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
Evolving fast, last year they legalized gay marriage in 2015. But it would be a little naive to ignore generations worth of repression. That's interesting cultural territory, specifically as an incubator for counterculture. And we're not just talking modern writers and filmmakers. A piece I remember reading in junior high was Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, which reads like a satirical, almost horror comedy some 200 years before the Realist magazine here in the States or National Lampoon. For those who don't remember reading the satirical essay when you were 14, A Modest Proposal, the title continues, for preventing the children of poor people from being a burden to their parent country or making them beneficial to the public, is an essay that promotes the sale and eating of babies as a way of for poor people to ease their own money troubles and lessen their burden on society.
Very The Road, you know? Very early The Road. And yeah, Ireland has had lots and lots of problems always. I mean, it is like every country been invaded and taken over, and the people who were existing there were then enslaved or put into servitude.
And we talked about them briefly in the Scandinavian horror episode that so everybody should be aware of, like the English and the Irish relationship that's little touchy. But long before that, Vikings came over, stole their women, and took them to Iceland and created the whole subculture into itself. So as like the underdogs of history, it starts to inform the like dark sense of humor and the
Absolutely.
Sort of self-deprecating nature. At least those are my general assumptions.
I also, because when we decided to do this episode, I was like, well, what do I actually know about Ireland? And I know a lot of Irish music. I absolutely love Irish music, traditional Irish music. So I love that. But other than that, other than the music, I really don't know that much about it. And we started like naming things we knew about it. It was very little. And I think for a country like America that boasts so many Irish Americans, we don't really have very much history that we teach in the United States.
We've got like the cereal box version of history.
Yeah.
So of the few things I did know, I knew that Ireland had an economic boom in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And that informs this episode because it speaks to the Irish Film Board and the idea that with their money, they invested in infrastructure and the arts. And the Irish Film Board that sort of came and went in the 80s, came back strong in the 90s.
Right. Like most countries that are not the United States, the country actually invests in the arts. So it's like a foreign thing to us in the States because we could give a crap about art, apparently. But in Ireland, they have the Irish Film Board. And Ireland had some really bad years in the 70s and the 80s as far as economic times. But in 1980 through 87, they had the Irish Film Board started. And it disappeared just because the economy was so bad and they couldn't there was no public support for any money going to anything besides just living day to day. And then the economy took a huge, huge swing upwards. And so in 93, the film board comes back, and it comes back kind of after movies like Crying Game was so successful. Oh. Movies like My Left Foot is an Irish film. And one of my personal favorites, The Commitments. It's like a feel-good movie. I love horror movies, but goddamn, if The Commitments is on TV, I'm going to sit there and watch it. I'm going to watch the entire fucking thing. So after that kind of success, they said, listen, we're making some good films here in Ireland. And they started up the Irish Film Board in 93. In 2015, so just last year, they allotted about 14 million euros for distribution, development, production, all of that. And this year, in 2016, because of films like Room and Brooklyn, which are Irish films.
I didn't know Room was.
Because of those films and that success, they're working with the IDA, which provides like taxing help. Incentives.
Incentives.
Yeah. So it provides incentives to get people to start filming, especially in Ireland, because even some of these Irish movies that we're going to talk about aren't all filmed in Ireland, and it's not using all Irish actors.
It's always the quiet places where the mad shit happens.
They're pilot whales. They died at sea.
I can't be self a sea monster.
This is something totally different. Something alien.
You don't believe me?
Not a bit.
Christ. What did I tell you?
I believe in coincidences.
Not really.
You are so lucky she didn't kill you.
You were drunk.
If we taint our blood with booze, we're poisonous to eat.
It's extraordinary.
Stay out of the rain, and we drink.
You're throwing a party.
It's a welcome party for me.
But you're leaving in a fortnight.
It's just a goodbye party, whatever.
Tequila! Okay.
She's out of the door.
You've got all under control. There's none trying to kill you.
Have you got some tags on you?
Not on me, no.
All right, we're going to kick off the St. Patrick's Day episode with 2012's Grabbers, which I watched randomly. It was like one of those Netflix thinks I might like this because I was watching so much Spanish and English horror at the time. It like threw in some Irish horror.
She likes international flavors.
Exactly. And so then I started watching a lot of Irish films, and Grabbers was one of them that I never forgot. Rewatching it again for this episode is one of my favorite movies, actually. I really love it. It was directed by John Wright and written by Kevin Lehane. And I think it's just an absolute gem. And I'm so glad we got to talk about it.
I think in terms of like straight fun, it's the most fun of these films. And yeah, it was one that was on Netflix for a long period of time. And honestly, like I eventually just like relented.
Because it sounds terrible. The title is bad. It's not good.
It's funny. And it'll come up in terms of like the, you know, I'm going to make some broad assumptions about like an Irish sense of humor and the sort of underdog quality where they're okay taking the piss out of themselves. But yeah, when this was on Netflix, it was on my front page constantly. Like, you might like this.
And you're
might like
this. I don't want to watch that.
But I eventually saw it and I was like, I should have watched that a long time ago.
Yes,
and
it's great.
And now it's off of Netflix streaming, too bad. So the listeners got to find it elsewhere.
But, I rented it on Amazon it's worth it. It's absolutely. I wish I would have bought it, honestly, because I kind of want to watch it again and again.
There should be a plan. Like if you you rent to buy, like you should be able to buy it and just have that money taken off. It shouldn't be a double dip. But in any case, yeah. So Grabbers takes place on an island off the coast of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And we are introduced to Garda Lisa Nolan, who is the newcomer to the town, the old sheriff, so to speak.
She's going on vacation.
Ireland, so everybody's got a different title.
But, right.
I don't know. Senior Garda is taking a vacation. And so we are left behind with Richard Coyle, who's playing Garda, Kieran O'Shea.
Right.
And Lisa Nolan is the new cop in town.
And O'Shea is just not equipped to handle this island town by himself, which it seems to be a town of maybe 40 people.
It seems that way. And we're going to talk about it more and more, but the sort of tight community dynamics mm-hmm. that we see in like these Irish stories is even more exaggerated when we go off the coast of Ireland to this like fishing village where it's even more secluded. And, you know, it's a small community, so everybody knows everybody. And Lisa is kind of playing the viewer in terms of introductions
exactly.
to this town.
Because she's from the big city of Dublin.
She's our vessel.
That she's wandered in here. But O'Shea, raging alcoholic.
Yeah, he's
pathetic.
Kind of a play on, like, the grizzled cop who's always either drunk or hungover.
Yeah.
But he's got
he's
a sense of humor. He's not.
He's
not morose.
No, no. He's not a bad guy. I mean, later when you find out more things about him, he is kind of a sad character.
Yeah.
But he's still, you know, he's a very functioning alcoholic, I would say.
He's got that going for him. But yeah, as the story progresses and he kind of recognizes what he as a human being needs to do to be his best self. And then it starts to resemble that dynamic in the movie Airplane where the guy's like,
it's like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking. It's like I picked the wrong week to quit drinking. It's like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines. It's like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
But okay, so the movie, is it funny that naming itself Grabbers and there's a specific scene that comes to that.
Right.
It is kind of this note of like, we're not going to take ourselves too seriously.
Right. Like, this is the worst thing that we could call this creature. But just because everyone likes saying it, that's what we'll do.
It's the most like silly, generic. It really is. Like if you were to ask a 4-year-old, it's like we found this little alien in a lobster trap.
I've never seen anything like it before. It's a completely foreign species. I can't even begin to originate or class it.
A grabber.
Yeah, grabber. It grabs meat people. It's a grabber.
Yeah, but so there are. It's funny for his self-referential and, you know, specific with some of the references in the movies, it's very self-aware in terms of other horror movies. Mm-hmm. There are at least 2 nods to the Alien franchise.
Yes.
Even the stuff on the boat reminded me specifically of John Carpenter's The Fog, where
it's the opening scene. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's this boat, like, just close enough to the coast where, like, we see it, but it's not coming in. No one's responding. Something terrible has happened. And we get a firsthand look at this alien that fell to Earth.
Yeah.
Which
seems to be from a meteor or something. I'm kind of confused about that.
It's funny, but it kind of worked in the same way as Cloverfield, where it just lands in the ocean and now you've got an alien problem. But this alien is waterbound and very sensitive to alcohol. Kind of the opposite of Kieran O'Shea.
What does that mean?
All this thing needs to survive is blood and water.
Yes, that's right. So he chose a bad place to land and come ashore because this is a fun-loving island community.
Yeah.
It seems like a good time. Everyone's involved. Even like Gran is involved in everything, you know?
Everybody in town. Yeah, I mean, the idea of like your local pub, your community pub is like even concentrated to this one spot on the cliffside, the bar on the cliffside,
mm-hmm.
that apparently the whole town fits in. But
that's what I'm saying. There's like maybe 40 people.
Yeah, hard drinking people, fishermen and the like. And but sorry, this is all to say that the alien won't consume someone who's hammered drunk.
Right, which they discover because one of the only people who's seen the alien and lived is the town drunk, who actually brings alcohol into the bar, you find out later. So he's not even just drinking at the bar, but he's also brought like moonshine into the bar.
That's how you do.
Well, he says a bird can't fly with one wing.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know. So he needs alcohol and another something.
All right. He's constantly chasing alcohol in his pocket.
Yeah, he said it in an Irish accent. I thought, that's a very wise statement, sir.
Wise and or obvious, but right, said with an accent, it sounds like that saying's got to be 500 years old,
right?
At least.
And he is your stereotypical drunk town yokel kind of fella,
yeah,
and his name is Patty.
But it's okay because it's Irish filmmakers making this movie in Ireland. And actually, speaking of, I was kind of surprised, and it took a second viewing to remind myself that, like, this is a gorgeous film,
beautiful, yeah,
and It's shot on location. Incidentally, it was one of the coldest winters they had ever experienced there, and it's going to come up again in Citadel.
But right.
The UK just had a rough winter in 2011. But so Ireland, like, I don't know if it's ever looked this good to me in a film. Like, it's really impressive. And so you've got, like, your kind of standard go-to Irish pastures, but also this, like, seaside, cliffside town.
That, this is,
like,
beautiful. I mean, I think...
the aerial photography
later
is great.
When we talk about From the Dark, that was one thing in that film, that they're driving through the countryside, and it is so beautiful. It made me want to go drive around in Ireland until the shit hits the fan, and then I think, no, maybe not.
Ireland and good lighting is going to be crucial.
Yes, it must be daylight. Even though these grabbers seem to come out any time of day.
There was a surprising amount of daytime horror, considering, like, you know, any horror movie is going to capitalize on the darkness and the shadows, but, like, they didn't give a fuck. That alien came out at any given time. And actually, speaking of the alien, so, well, I don't know if you could spoil the alien exactly.
Now, this is something totally different. Something alien.
It's like a...
octopus-y guy?
Octopus Cthulhu-esque without, like, any vestige of anthropomorphic anything.
Right.
So I really liked how...
mouth
just
only.
Animal. Like, yeah. It was very mouth-oriented. It was kind of like the underside of a squid.
Yeah. I don't...
But
I'm
it also how it moved
biologist.
was very cool.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, the monster is mostly CGI.
I'm not offended by it, though, honestly. It doesn't
it was done
bother
really well.
Me, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess there were occasional pieces that you could tell, like, there were practical effects in the scene. Mm-hmm. So they were doing a merging of CGI and practical effects, and that stuff worked really well. And actually, on that note, a lot of the comedy, and we talked about how the movie's not afraid to, like, take the piss out of the characters and really just sort of poke fun at every character with every opportunity. But, like, the face hugger scene, and, like, there are moments of, like, out and out physical comedy that, yeah, I don't know. I think it works because the tone is set pretty early.
And, right.
Yeah.
Now, early on, there's a couple that this is right when everything's starting. And there's a couple who, you know, they're your married couple, middle-aged married couple. And there's, like, a knock on the door, and the man goes to open the door, and he looks through the peephole, and it's his friend is kind of, like, hanging there. And then he still opens the door, and the friend is, like, we notice as the viewer that the friend's toes are barely touching the ground. The alien is literally holding him up like a puppet. And to me, that's one of the funniest scenes, because the man who's in the house just assumes that his friend is drunk.
What does he want?
Right.
And that's why he's acting like that. And he just goes, oh, you're drunk, that's why. And I love that scene. I think
I don't know
it's
about
so
you.
Funny.
When I'm drunk, I levitate 2 inches off the ground.
Obviously.
Are you all right, Mitch?
Only.
So I mentioned the cinematography, and it bears mention. Trevor Forrest was the cinematographer, and I looked at his IMDb, and he seems young enough that, like, this came out in 2012, and he's got tons of work between then and now and upcoming. So I don't know. I expect he's going to come up more and more in the genre. But again, like, it is for a horror comedy. You don't typically think of, like, horror comedies as being stunning to look at, but this
was really pretty.
Yeah, this was really good. This was one of those that, like, every I don't have any complaints about this movie.
The only thing that I noticed at the very beginning was there were some transitions between scenes that they used, like, a sort of fade into, and I see it now and I think it's a little, I don't know, like, cheesy, I guess, is what I want to say. It's a little, like...
Did I miss Star Wipes?
It's almost. It's, like, really close to that to me. And that's the only thing wrong with this movie. And it only happens, it's only so noticeable in the first 20 minutes of the film. And you're just like, why did that... It's just really bad transitions from the intro scenes for the first 20 minutes. And that's the only... Because I think to myself, what's wrong with this movie? Why doesn't everyone talk about this movie all the time?
Yeah, this should have been much bigger. Yeah. And especially, yeah, I don't know. It's a great monster movie.
And we were talking, like, I think English Irish do horror comedy like nobody else. Like, this is its own style thing, because I couldn't think of anything American that compares to this film?
I read Kevin's script and I thought it was brilliant and I thought it was original.
I just wanted to write a movie that had never been done out of Ireland before and was a film that I would actually go see on a Friday night, even if it was raining. And yeah, just to celebrate Ireland and celebrate the movies that I loved.
This never gets hokey. It comes close every once in a while, just with, like, I don't know, eventually characters are very drunk.
Yes.
And I will say, actually, some of the drunk acting, very good.
Well, what the director actually did was take some of the main actors and get them really drunk.
John said to us, can we go out? And he said, I want us all to get really drunk, the three of us. Let's get really drunk and I'm going to film you. And then I'm going to play it back to you so you can see, you know, just so you've... Because I'd never actually seen myself being drunk on film. You hadn't.
No.
And that's what happened, is we got horrendously slaughtered. He got us very drunk, filmed us, and then I refused to watch it. You watched it.
I watched it, yeah. I watched it. I went around to his apartment and watched it, and it was just horrific, you know, and then we got rid of it afterwards. It was just... And obviously, John was pretty drunk too, so it's quite queasy watching.
What was hilarious about this is he took the camera out, and I remember this clearly, even though I was very drunk. He could not figure out how to work the camera. I was like, this is not a good sign. We haven't even started filming yet, and you can't even turn the camera on. He won't like the fact that we've mentioned that.
Oh, God, yeah, it was very embarrassing.
So I do want to point out, along with the two main Garda guys, is Russell Tovey, who is, I guess it's because it's an island, but there's only so many people on this island. And Russell Tovey plays this English marine biologist, mm-hmm. or a fancier title for marine biologist.
He might refer to himself as like an ecologist, marine ecologist.
Yeah, something like whatever.
Yeah. When the whales wash up on shore, he's kind of the go-to guy to explain
right.
how they got
and
there.
And I kind of wondered, maybe because it's an island he's there, but why would this English guy be in this weird island of 40 people living there? And seems like no one likes him.
Well, he's English, right? His character's English.
Yes. And he's kind of like a brat. He's kind of, he thinks he's better than everybody else.
So, they're dead. Dead? Oh, no, they're just sleeping.
Yeah, but I think he's great, and I know him from History Boys, and I just love when he shows up in the weirdest things, and you're just like, oh, yeah, it's that kid. And I think he's one of the best drunks in the entire film.
Yeah.
Because he gets, like,
funny.
English drunk in that. He goes all out.
So, yeah, this was on Netflix streaming for a while, but totally worth a rental. Mm-hmm. This one's fun. Watch this with a group of people. Have a drink or two. Enjoy yourself.
Also, you didn't hear it from me, but if you speak French, you can see it in the French overdub for free on YouTube.
Okay, so let's jump right into a far more somber,
darker film.
Citadel from 2012, written and directed by Kieran Foy, who is Irish, although the movie itself takes place in Glasgow, Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
So the IMDb synopsis goes as follows. An agoraphobic father teams up with a renegade priest to save his daughter from the clutches of a gang of twisted feral children who committed an act of violence against his family years earlier. That's actually not true. This is like the umpteenth IMDb description that's also a horrible run-on sentence.
But it's also not exactly true because...
It's kind of a...
That kid...
This is like the action movie description of this film.
Yeah, but it's like years earlier because the baby's like maybe a year old.
I think
so, let's tune the listener in here. So there it opens with a couple and the wife is pregnant and they're getting groceries or whatever. They're in this big building.
They're a young couple who, like, they're young enough that kind of being poor makes sense. It's just kind of par for the course.
Yeah, so they're in this huge, you know, housing development where the elevators don't work.
Yeah.
And
here we would call it a project.
Yes. I'll call it a housing development because I assume everything's fancier in the UK. So that's what I'll call that. But he's stuck now in the elevator with his pregnant wife outside of the elevator when these kids in hoodies just beat the shit out of her.
They come out of nowhere and they're just like nihilist asshole kids.
Yeah.
And he has to watch the whole thing through the elevator
glass.
In the
elevator.
And then he's pushing buttons and it eventually takes him downstairs because that's fucked up fate. But by the time he gets upstairs, his wife is like on death's door, has a syringe sticking out of her stomach. Like,
yes.
This is the thing of nightmares.
Yeah. And so now she's put on life support and the baby is born.
Healthy.
Yeah, the baby is fine. He's now raising this child. The wife is on life support. And he, at the beginning of this film, decides to take her off of it.
So the father of the story is Tommy, played by Aniran Barnard.
Yeah.
Do I have that right?
Who's Welsh, but he's in this show for all intents and purposes.
Yeah. And he's like a young, skinny, I mean, by like visual standards, he's kind of emo looking, especially after he's lost enough sleep that he's got dark, dark rings under his eyes.
Which is funny because, yeah, if you look up that name, Aniran, it's actually a term for dark. It means dark.
Really?
And like, clearly this is a dark-haired, dark-eyed guy.
On the nose. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. He was named perfectly by his mother.
So he struggles with debilitating agoraphobia. Mm-hmm.
And from this, based off of this particular attack.
And I didn't realize until looking into it, all I knew of agoraphobia is fear of the outside. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I saw Sigourney Weaver in Copycat, and that's the approximation of my knowledge. but looking into it, it's very closely tied into panic disorder. So this is a little bit from the Mayo Clinic's website talking about agoraphobia. Agoraphobia is an anxiety disorder that often develops after one or more panic attacks. It's a type of anxiety disorder in which you fear and often avoid places or situations that might cause you to panic and make you feel trapped, helpless, or embarrassed. With agoraphobia, you fear an actual or anticipated situation, such as using public transportation, being in open or enclosed spaces, standing in line, or being in a crowd. And all these things come up in the movie.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And he is ultra aware of his triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to so much of the tension of the movie. And I was thinking about that like, this is such a personal condition. I think different people have, like, you know, any number of variations
sure.
of these symptoms and like little bits and pieces where you're, you know, you might not like crowds or you
that's
might not
the
like
human condition. Absolutely.
Elevators. But taking this condition and relaying it to like a movie going crowd, like that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of the story is kind of you getting more familiar with Tommy and sharing his dread.
Right.
And so I thought it was impressive on that level that it's tough to take something that personal and sort of sell it as the, like, you know, it is the fear basis of the film.
Sure.
Well, the kids are the fear basis of the film, and they're the second. One of the things I wasn't crazy about was some of the writing here and there was a little silly, but they refer to sensing fear or smelling fear and victimhood a number of times. And so he's in these like group therapy sessions with other people who share a similar condition. And the counselor, I wonder how true to life this is. The filmmaker Kieran Foy dealt with some, if not all, of these issues because he, as a teenager, was brutally assaulted and hit over the head with a hammer and all by teenagers.
Right, right.
And so he dealt with a good bit of agoraphobia himself. So between research and personal experience, like, there's a reason this story is so personal.
Right.
When I was 18, I was the victim of a pretty vicious and unprovoked attack by a gang of youths. I was beaten with a hammer and pretty horrendous ordeal. But what it left me with was this condition, agoraphobia, which is what the main character in the film battles with and suffers with. But I'm also a kind of a lifelong geek, you know, so I kind of wanted to blend the two and to see what happened. And I did that and wrote Citadel and seemed like, yeah, hey, let's try and make this.
But you know what? As it goes on, I think the audience really can relate with Aniran because he has every reason to fear what's going on.
Yeah.
Even the little things like fearing public transportation, because there's literally one bus that takes him from the hospital home. And if you don't make that bus, you're fucked. So it's like, I do understand his panic and absolutely things
like
that.
Yeah, it's from like a metaphysical sense of dread to like literally just being stranded in the middle of nowhere. He lives in seemingly the worst neighborhood in Scotland where the bus doesn't go like closer, any closer than a mile to his home. And so he's got like a baby carriage,
right,
and a, you know, diaper bag and whatnot on his back. And so he is always tethered down. Like that is, you know, an
he
extra
should have
monkey
got
on his back.
A baby, like a baby Bjorn.
Bjorn.
That's what he, that would have,
I was
the
thinking,
movie would have been entirely different.
When he was running away from the kids pushing the stroller, mm-hmm. I was puzzled why he didn't pull the kid out, because I would think you could
move
faster.
Because the baby's strapped in. He does at one point in time run.
After to get on the bus.
But he has to like unclip the baby because the baby's strapped in and all this shit.
Yeah.
Because he also has, because of his agoraphobia, he is essentially like under the spotlight of CPS. It seems.
Yeah, and his social worker plays a big part in the story.
And they keep kind of visiting him. So he also has to be the perfect father in every other way. So he's very specific about feeding the baby and strapping the kid in and making sure the kid's clean and this and that.
This is no place to raise a child.
Tommy, you know moving away isn't going to stop social services chasing you. You just have to prove to them that you're a good dad.
I'm not going to let them take it away from me.
No.
It's only been a month since his wife died. You look at his character and he's in shambles.
Yes.
So trying to like take care of himself and his kid, he can only take care of his kid.
Right.
He's not, there's no amount of like self-maintenance going on with him. He is a physical disaster.
And when the shit really starts to hit the fan, it's after his wife's funeral. He's already kind of been warned about crazy stuff going on by this, you know, shady priest out of the blue. And then he has literally the worst day ever in that he misses the only bus out there. He breaks his door on accident because it won't open. So now he can only use the slidey hook chain to close his door. Then he spills the formula.
Yeah, that was a rough night.
Yeah, it's a terrible
night.
The
lights are in and out because this neighborhood is
hell.
Like going to be condemned tomorrow.
And that's so, when he first actually has the kids come into his house. It's like the worst day ever.
Yeah, so you mentioned the priest character and he mm-hmm. comes up in the synopsis, but James Cosmo is one of these actors. I recognized him. I wasn't sure from where. He is Brendan Gleeson's dad in Braveheart. He is the old tough
right.
guy who has his hand cut off and still continues fighting. He's this like great grizzled character who is seemingly just ready to give it all up. Like he doesn't like anything. Like
no.
he's one of these characters who's just like cranky and bitter. And we find him in a kitchen and or meth lab, and you're not sure what he's making.
Excuse me, Father.
Faint! Jesus Christ! Who gave you permission to come in here? Huh?
At the cemetery, you said they come looking for my daughter.
Get out!
But they came last night.
Yeah, that was confusing. I'm so confused.
And then it turns out
yeah.
explosives. He was
yeah.
making explosives.
But it's like, where did he get access to all these things?
Oh, well, you know what? They did allude. He only has, it says a couple of lines, but he kind of alludes that he might have done some bombing in the 80s and 90s.
I see.
And that we kind of talk about that a little bit in the intro in terms of the divide of North and Southern Ireland. But so, yeah, I like that they didn't linger on that point. It really just was kind of like a little bit of a peek
That's
at this guy's past. And later we get a much better
exactly.
view of his past. And it's all grim.
And
you know why he's cranky.
Exactly. And along with the priest, you get Danny, who is a blind kid.
Weird little kid.
Strange child. And then you learn that Danny had once been going to be one of these
feral
children.
In the early
script,
they referred to
him
as Hoods.
In the script, they were called the Hoods. They don't really have a name in the movie. They're just feral kids. And so I was just taking imagery of things that I was afraid of the gang that attacked me. It was based on imagery and things from my own life.
So if I've got one or two complaints about the movie, it's that these young kids early, say like, the first two acts of the film, they're terrifying.
Yes.
When they transition from like just lingering in the shadows mm-hmm. to like outright violence and ultra violence and assault, like it is nerve-wracking.
Yes.
It really is upsetting. But the more they're on camera, it kind of that dissolves. That sort of the mystery of these sort of like twitchy kids kind of goes away. And mm-hmm. I was a little frustrated because even the like sound design of their attacks is really unsettling the whole time.
Yeah.
But eventually, like, yeah, I don't know. I think they might have used them a little too much.
I did like, yeah, just seeing them kind of in the shadows. I loved when you see them behind the glass, behind the frosted glass. Okay. I think that's so very scary, you know, and their faces are usually at the beginning
that,
covered.
Like, long, skinny arm through the door.
They're so gross. I think this movie is really great. And I guess maybe they're overused, but it doesn't kind of ruin it for me. And I think the biggest thing that keeps this movie all together and for me doesn't ruin it is the music. It's entirely scored by Tom and Andy, who actually are Americans, but they make this beautiful, beautiful score. And I just think, like, I was listening to it and I was rewatching it again. And that when it finally finished, I leaned over to you and I said, this music is beautiful. This is amazing. It's the same people Tom and Andy did Killing Zoe, Waking the Dead, Mothman Prophecies. Like, they're making some great film scores. Yeah. And this was beautiful.
I think it was a trivia note on IMDb that the filmmaker Kieran Foy was listening to their work in writing this, so it was kind of a perfect score that they could work on the score to his movie.
And it makes sense too because they both do Sinister 2 later.
Oh, did they do Sinister 2 with
yeah.
him?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, Kieran Foy went on to do the sequel to Sinister, which came out last year. It wasn't so well received, although it sounds like a different enough take on the original premise that I'm going to give it a shot at some point. I'll definitely check that out. So I was talking about the kids and the sort of my frustration towards the end where they're overused. So much of the movie is this like elevated, this heightened reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a dark fantasy at times, but it still maintains high stakes when characters get attacked and, you know, these sort of like terrifying chase sequences take place. So I don't know that the characters come into play. I never needed to see any of their faces, and it's not as if they're well lit at any point, but I would have liked a certain, just enough anonymity to them where you could question, like, is this all happening in his mind?
Sure, sure, sure. And I think, you know, when you see Danny, he sort of starts to kind of look a little fucked up. So, like, you would get, I think, the idea. You didn't really need to see the kids' faces.
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, a kid that was stopped, like, halfway through becoming one of these kids.
You want to know why they're after you? Because you fear them. You fear them. They see it. They can see fear. Sense it. Smell it. Otherwise, they're mostly blind to everything else.
What are you talking about?
Fear. It's what they're born into, what attracts them to the victims. They thrive on it and they draw it out, and it's your fear they're attracted to, and consequently else.
So I don't think it's a far stretch to think of the movie as an allegory for, you know, the story of a father sort of feeling overwhelmed mm-hmm. and maybe incapable of raising a child by himself. And there's definite repeat mentions of like trauma and being plagued by post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mentioned that the filmmaker Kieran was himself a survivor of this. And so you can definitely see just how personal the movie is.
Right.
Like the, you know, in little glimpses, and I'll bring in clips from Kieran talking about the attack that he suffered and sort of turning it around into, you know, this piece of like really dark, creepy fiction.
Yeah, that it's
serves
great.
As a pretty great horror movie.
And this is a film that, again, I watched it the same time I watched Grabbers, honestly, because
Irish horror kick.
Yeah, because I was on this kick and you just don't hear about it. And I don't know why, because let's say that some of the kids maybe are overexposed. Some of the monster part is overexposed. It's so very little. I'm just surprised that it wasn't more successful.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's production. I don't know if that's the Irish Film Board.
I think it's probably
like
more distribution, considering mm-hmm. like this was like a festival darling, and this definitely made a name for him, but it was the first time anyone had ever heard Kieran Foy's name. And so
I think it's
he's
great.
Definitely been embraced by the horror community, and he's talked about working in the genre. And so, Yeah, I mean, I think he's just getting started. He's a pretty young guy. But yeah, looking forward to, well, maybe not Sinister 2, but I'll look forward to the next thing. Before we jump off to The Canal from 2014, I did want to talk about the movie Them as being kind of similar, if not maybe inspiring, elements of The Citadel.
Sure, I could see that.
Them was a 2006 film by David Moreau and Xavier Palud. It is a home invasion story with these sort of anonymous children. And so there's a lot of corresponding visuals between these two movies. I think they are far more careful with showing the kids in the movie Them.
Sure,
and
yes.
So yeah, if memory serves, it was a... So it's a French film. However, I think it was made in like Hungary or Romania. I don't remember which.
Them, especially the visual elements of Them, it really feeds off of the darkness.
Yeah. Yeah, and the whole story takes place at night.
Sometimes I think when you're saying it's like overexposing the kids in the Citadel, it's because there's so much light in it. I mean, it is a dark film, but yeah, not like Them. Them is very dark.
Yeah. Citadel takes place over the course of a number of days and months even. Whereas Them is a single night.
Right.
And it's a husband and wife couple out in their country house and local kids looking to start some shit.
Yeah.
But okay, so going from Citadel to The Canal from 2014, written and directed by Ivan Kavanaugh. He's written and directed all his own work and edited most of his work as well. However, The Canal was edited by Robin Hill with cinematography by Piers McGrail. It's kind of, you see a common theme between a lot of these films as being like writer-director works. And I think one of the reasons they are as compelling as they are is because it is a singular vision.
Right.
These guys...
It is their baby for that amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, and in the case of Citadel, we see that was clearly the filmmaker working through some issues.
Right, right.
Yeah. So The Canal stars Rupert Evans, who I only know from Hellboy, Guillermo del Toro's
Hellboy
movie. And in that, a little rough with the American accent, and I think it might have been distracting. He's very good in this.
Yes.
He's able to use his natural accent. So his co-stars are Hannah Hoekstra, playing his wife, Calum Heath is the adorable little boy.
Yes.
And Antonia Campbell-Hughes is his coworker and fellow
film archivist. Who I swear I've seen before, but I don't really recognize any of the films she's in. So, and she's a very interesting looking person.
She is, yeah.
So I don't know where she like sticks out in my mind, but I clearly remember her.
So a synopsis of the film kind of goes as follows. Film archivist David and his pregnant wife find an old Irish house they love by a canal with a series of locks, which, for those who don't know, sections of a narrow river can be sealed off to allow water to build up so boats can move upstream. In any case, their house is near that. The story jumps ahead 5 years and they have a little boy, but the marriage is fading. David suspects that his wife is cheating on him with a pretty gross client.
Yeah, he's gross. She's gross. She's so bad. Like,
yeah.
When there's a scene where David kind of really puts two and two together with the wife and this guy.
At the party?
And he's such a scumbag, and she's such a scumbag, too, and I hate her.
Yeah, it was pretty bothersome. And the guy, I don't know, he's scummy looking. He's got a man bun. I mean, that should tell
you. He's kind of handsome, though. You would definitely cheat with that guy, for sure.
I don't know if that was... So all the stress is compounded when David's work partner, Claire, gives him a reel of to-be-archived footage that shows that his house was the setting for a brutal murder in 1902. I don't think we should say too much more about the plot itself, because
no.
I found that it was just thin enough that it would be easy to spoil.
Right.
And I like so much about this movie that I thought it was kind of a bummer that it telegraphs kind of early what's happening. If you're watching it very closely, it might almost seem obvious.
I think the first time I watched it, because last night I watched it again, but the first time I watched it, I'm one of those people, I will just go with it and I don't figure it out until like...
Yeah, me too. I'm not
Until
I'm not
he
digging,
drops
yeah.
that ring in Sixth Sense, I do not know what's going on. So this to me was like... or she drops the ring, sorry. But like, that's when I figure it out. But this one, I don't remember figuring it out. The second time through, I feel like I definitely got it. So I don't know, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, which all of this isn't to say that the movie is bad.
No,
but it does
love
kind
it.
Of spend, in my mind, it kind of spent a lot of the movie getting back what it might have lost in the first 20 minutes of it. But that said, like, I loved it. I thought it did
very
well.
I think it's great. I think he's great in this film. There's such these moments of incredible tension, which is incredibly aided by the sound design.
Mm.
There is this sound early on in the movie of this just expansion of, like, breaking out of metal, wood, everything. It's just so expansive sounding, and I love that sound.
Yeah, well, we can talk about a little bit the idea that this canal, I don't know how common this is, but there is a public restroom off of this walking path next to the canal, and it is worse than the bathroom from Trainspotting.
Yeah, it's what I expect a bathroom in, like, our subway system. If we would have bathrooms in our subway system, I assume they would look very similar to this.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
So half of that horror is just that he's touching it.
Oh, kind of with his face at one point in time. It's so gross. Like, I can't even.
So it's that bathroom stall that in this sort of, you know, vomitous haze, the stall wall is, like, breathing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it all kind of builds up. I thought you were going to get at the later scene where he is witness to his own personal tragedy, and it is mostly scored. I don't think there's any audio from the scene in the scene. It is purely score.
Mm-hmm.
And Rupert Evans, it's strange to, because this particular moment almost plays like a silent film in terms of his reaction to it. And it is dramatic and impactful. And it kind of makes you angry that, like, genre films aren't taken seriously in terms of, like, achievements in acting.
I know, but I think he's great. And, you know, something about his face, he has a very, like, boyish quality to his face.
Sure,
and so occasionally he has this ability to look so wide-eyed and confused and vulnerable, and I really love him. Yeah. I think
he's
great.
He's very physical at times. But that particular scene is a series of, like, zoom in shots and these, like, long takes intercut with one another, and it felt like Kubrick-esque. It felt like moments out of The Shining in terms of, like, the production, and I have to imagine that must have been a factor.
Oh, definitely. This movie was very much, I think, influenced by other stories that we've seen and heard before and other ideas. And it had a house that has walls big enough to walk between. And that always fascinates me in horror films because,
like, the people under the stairs.
Yeah. I've never seen a house where you could walk in the walls.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in a house that you could walk in the walls?
How would I know?
I don't know. It just
I've
seems
never
like,
walked in the walls of a house. No,
I think it's just like
I can safely say that
crazy anomaly that only happens in horror films.
I think you're right. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Aside from, like, the H.H. Holmes horror castle,
exactly.
Like, there's not, a lot of call for that.
I think if the walls are thick enough for you to walk in between, you should get the fuck out of the house.
Yeah, I think these days, I don't know. I've seen enough HDTV that, like, they just fill that with foam, so it kills, like, the sound. It deadens the sound.
It doesn't make any sense.
And good for insulation.
But I'm constantly baffled, and in this house, because this is essentially a haunted house kind of story as well.
Yeah.
And the ability to go between the walls is kind of important.
So the film uses a lot of archive footage, grainy black and white film. It's David's job to maintain these, like, old film canisters and also the cameras themselves, and they play a big part. It's funny that, like, in the modern tradition of digital cameras and infrared picking up ghosts and spirits and what have you, this kind of goes backwards. Where
right, and I love that.
This character, who was, you know, a tenant from 100 years ago, only appears on film.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, David sort of takes the camera home to investigate, to figure out what's going on in his home.
Which I thought also was kind of interesting, that, you know, how America was so obsessed with spiritualism in the turn of the century in America.
Yeah.
And they loved group seances and they loved taking pictures of the dead or different things like that. So I thought it was interesting that this is a film in Ireland focusing again on ritual, macabre or spiritual things.
Yeah, the footage that he is presented with. And I think this might be a little bit of a leap, because I'd be pretty shocked if the police actually took video footage some video footage, film footage on crime scenes. I think even at the time, photography, just standard photography, would have been a leap in the likelihood. But in any case, there is archival footage from the crime scene that is his home. And so actually, speaking of the film, and I want to talk about the editing a little bit, because every once in a while, there are moments in the editing that call attention to themselves. There are these brief jump cuts, and while I didn't find them jarring, they definitely do call attention to themselves. And I thought it was a little bit of a reminder, if not a sort of comment on the subjective nature of what we're watching, in terms of like, he is constantly watching footage.
Yes.
And then, you know, in premise, we are watching the footage of his life unfolding. And I thought it was a little bit of like just a reminder that what you're watching is just as subjective as what he's watching. And
I took it kind of as the way that David sees things. Okay. And so sometimes even there's like a little bit of overlap. And I think that's really important. And I think that's why I think I like the film as a huge, like, entire unit, because I think everything fits together really beautifully with that.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that. Speaking of components to the film, the audio plays a crucial role. Mm-hmm. And I actually became frustrated watching it on my television because my apartment's pretty noisy. And so even with the closed captions on to make sure I got all the ins and outs of their dialogue, I did miss out on moments that I was actually very impressed with the setup and the premise. And I won't say too much, but there's a moment where David is pressed his head up against the wall because he swears behind the wall he hears someone praying.
There it is. Listen. It's very faint.
What is it?
Just listen. You hear it?
I can't hear anything.
And that is a concept, fucking skews me out. It's still, like, I say it now, and it's really creepy to the extent where, like, it kind of makes my hair stand on end that, you know, whatever spirit or whatever's inhabiting your house, like, someone's in your walls praying.
That's right.
Terrifying.
I don't think, listening to the wall is never good. It's like looking through a peephole, just generally in real life. You know something's going to jump up and scare the shit out of you out of that peephole. And so you never press your ear to a wall either. I have so many rules to live by because of horror films, and I would never listen through like a wall.
Yeah, or a bathroom stall for that matter, like Scream 2.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
So Kavanaugh heavily focused on the film's sound, and he specifically commented on wanting the sound to be as important as the picture. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't use any pre-recorded or archived sounds. And for the listener, you know, if you're watching it on Netflix, I hope you have a good sound system. If not, watch it with headphones, because I think it definitely adds another dimension to it. And it's a great one.
Yeah, it's one of those films, because once I moved from murder apartment, then into my new apartment, I didn't re-put up my surround sound. And there's a few movies where I like get really disappointed at myself and say, why didn't you reset up your surround sound? This is one of those.
So despite his faults, I really did like the movie. I think it worked very well overall, and I'm excited for whatever Ivan Kavanaugh does next.
Yeah, I thought this was great. I hope you have more faith now in Rupert Evans, because I think he's really, really great. I just think sometimes when I think an actor has to put on an accent, it becomes a very muddled character. And sometimes I wish they would just keep their accent. I don't care, you know, that they have an accent.
Yeah.
It's going to impact the acting, if it's going to impact the entire film.
Is Sophie back in the room with you? Billy, I want you to move the laptop around, okay? Just move the laptop around so I can see the rest of the room. Go on, please. Keep moving. Keep moving the laptop. That's it, good boy. Move it a bit more. That's it. You just need to see the room.
So before we start with our next film, From the Dark, Let's stay on the note of vampires, and you've got something about Bram Stoker.
Yeah, Bram Stoker was actually Irish. He spent most of his time and worked in London and in England, but he was an Irish guy. And Bram, I found out, is short for Abraham.
It feels like I should know that. I had no idea.
Yeah, I had no clue. I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. He was originally from Dublin, and he actually says he accounts his creativity to the fact that when he was a kid, he was sick all the time. So all he did was spend time in bed, and that's how he kind of worked on writing.
Just alone with his imagination.
Yeah, which is kind of sad. But he, you know, did the right thing by his family, and he got a bachelor's in math, as people do, and then decided he really didn't want to do that. And because became a theater critic. Really? Yeah, right?
Theater critic. All right, that's a 180.
So he becomes a theater critic, and this is where it kind of gets a little interesting. Bram Stoker's wife originally dated, and I'm using funny quote fingers for that, dated Oscar Wilde. And so then Bram Stoker and Oscar Wilde were like at odds with each other for a while because Bram Stoker basically stole this lady from Oscar Wilde because I don't think Oscar Wilde really probably gave a fuck what this lady was doing, but whatever. So Bram Stoker marries her, and then later on, as they get older, Oscar Wilde and Bram Stoker become friends again.
Okay.
And Bram Stoker spends most of his life, actually, not with his wife, but with an actor who was a theater actor out of London. And they go on all these trips together, him and this actor. And Bram Stoker meets Theodore Roosevelt. He meets, and his favorite thing that he writes about and that he talks about when he goes to America is he meets Walt Whitman.
Oh, okay.
So
what an interesting literary time to live in.
Oh, he knows Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, he is where it's at in kind of like late 1800s London. So in 1897 is when he starts on Dracula. It was because of a friend of his who was telling him all about his travels through the Carpathian Mountains.
Okay.
And that's where he gets this idea for Dracula. But a lot of times Irish people or Irish literary people will tell you that the story also comes from Magnus O'Donnell, which is an old O'Donnell tribe in Ireland that was like a specific era of history.
As the inspiration for the character?
As the inspiration for...
I thought it was Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah, that's the thing. It is Vlad the Impaler, but... Huh. They, for certain, like the way that the castle is, the way that the city is, the way that the people are around Vlad the Impaler or Dracula, they associate it sometimes the O'Donnell tribe, which is kind of interesting because I don't see it, but I'm an American, so maybe like it's some Irish thing I don't understand or know anything about.
Sounds like rebranding, but all right.
Well, maybe it's just to bring it back like more Irish, I guess. I don't know. He wrote a lot of fiction for the Daily Telegraph in London, and that's when he wrote Lady of the Shroud, which is very early science fiction around 1902, and Lair of the White Worm. The only other thing about Bram Stoker that I kind of think is hilarious, and it made me giggle out loud, so I'll share it with you, is he died of syphilis. And
hilarious.
But because he was fancy, they didn't say he died of syphilis, because this is in the days when people would say how people died in the newspaper.
Okay.
But they called it locomotor ataxy.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, whatever. But that is, if you ever see that in historical things, it's a fancy way to say syphilis.
Huh.
They didn't want to embarrass people.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, he was a public figure.
Right.
Wow. So going from an Irish writer sort of inventing the modern Dracula tale to staying with what seems like an ancient vampire, we have From the Dark by Connor McMahon. Connor McMahon wrote and directed this. Neve Algar plays Sarah, and Stephen Cromwell plays Mark. Incidentally, his IMDb profile page has the wrong guy for his profile picture.
Aww, I just thought that was a random
bit. There are other photographs with him in them, but for some reason it's an older, slightly more attractive actor his profile picture is very strange.
He's like, this will do. I don't know who the stranger is.
But so Neve worked again with Connor McMahon in 2015 when McMahon put out Strangers in the Night, which is a short horror comedy where Neve plays a banshee.
Yay!
As the credits begin and the movie gets started, we're with a singular peat moss farmer working alone in his bog.
Which, yeah, the first time we watched, like, because we've talked about this before, but I didn't know what the hell that was. I was like, is this man a mud farmer?
It seemed that way.
Yeah. He's making very nice blocks of mud.
Meticulous, square, like with the post hole digger. It's very exact. But interestingly, the spot where he's digging is right next to a wall. And it only occurred to me on repeat viewing that, like, the surface is that he's like technically under the ground,
right?
About 6 feet under.
Ah.
And so when he digs up what appears to be like a sharpened stake, a spike, he pulls it out, looks at it curiously, and keeps digging, at which point he uncovers something of a pocket underneath the earth, mm-hmm. which could be like a decaying coffin.
Right, but which is a fatal mistake.
Inside, he sees an arm, this not skeleton. It is just a human, filthy arm with long nails tied to a plank.
Yeah.
And in my mind, they might have crucified a vampire under and just like buried him under the ground. It's a little unclear, but in any case, he's been under there a long time. And now without the stake in him, things are going to get ugly.
Right.
And this is just in the opening credits. And I really love the element of starting with a singular guy alone in this, you know, Irish hillside. It's almost like a silent film.
Right.
And there are actually so many, because it is only two characters, mostly in like stressful situations, if not like chase moments. This almost functions as a silent film. Like you get enough between the characters that you don't really need all that much dialogue.
I think that's a big trend in these movies. I mean, sans grabbers, these films all have very small casts, and it's very insular kind of community with these just very few people. And I think this is one of those movies. It's like two people and a vampire.
So when we are introduced to Sarah and David, they are a couple that's been together a long time. They're kind of like playfully bickering. And I don't know, you very quickly fall in love with them. I like them a lot.
They're so charming.
Yeah, the accents go a long way.
Yes?
Nothing.
Is there some words to follow that look? No?
No.
It's not that short.
It's short.
It's not that short. This is how short it was when we met each other. Yeah, you loved that guy,
didn't you? It was not.
Yes, it was. It was actually exactly like this.
I would have thought you would look like a criminal if
I don't look like a criminal.
If you had it that short when we met. I would have avoided you on the street with that haircut. Sorry.
You're mad. I was trying to make a smidge of an effort for a little getaway.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Why?
What?
Why are you making such an effort? It's like, that's like something someone would do if they were, I don't know, going to propose or something.
Going to propose?
Yeah.
People can get their hair cut without it leading to marriage. You mental head. Come here, okay.
It is beautifully shot by Michael Lavelle, and they make the most of the Irish countryside. But that said, like, the story kind of begins as the sun is setting.
Mm-hmm.
So at which point they have to make use of like available light, and the movie doesn't lose anything then really. It's not exactly John Carpenter's The Thing in terms of lighting at night, but there's a lot of like candlelight. There's, you know, some flashlights, there's phone lights. And it is just, I don't know, impressive that they make as much as they do with the shadows and silhouettes of these
Absolutely.
Characters.
The first time, you know, we did talk about this, and I've said many times before, I love watching the corner of a screen.
Yeah.
And this movie, because it is so dark and the way that the light is done in this, there's so much in the shadows and there's so much in the corners.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of my most favorite scenes is in the beginning. Their car breaks down and there is a...
Well, it gets stuck in the mud.
Or it gets stuck in the mud, yeah. And there is a lighter. They're using a lighter at that point in time. And in that very small burst of just the embers just igniting, you see the vampire's hand, and it is beautiful and it is so fucking scary. And I love that scene and I'll never forget that scene. That's a scene that to me makes this film.
Yeah. Well, there were a couple of those moments that I really liked. But so we are talking about a vampire story, an ancient vampire as it would be. And he's actually got some elements in common with like Nosferatu.
Yes.
He's far more of an animal than Nosferatu. And this time around, I did notice that like even just his posture and his mannerisms are like so different, and they're not particularly human.
Mm-hmm.
And I really dug that like it is something else.
Right.
This is not
an early creature.
Yeah.
That is like a derivative of people.
Right, right.
That's, you know, and I think he's great, and it's clearly influenced by Nosferatu with the hands, the ears, the head and everything. But the way he functions and the way he gets around is so strange. It's great acting by that guy.
In theory, he has been, you know,
cooped up for a while.
Yeah, he's been dormant for God knows how many hundreds of years. So between the old man, the peat moss farmer that he you know infects, and himself, like there are no like efficient killing machines in this movie. Like
yes.
They are kind of clumsy animals.
Yeah, another time. And sometimes I thought when I was watching it, he's like a crotchety old kind of animal because he's not good at seeing. He doesn't particularly hear very well. He doesn't really do anything.
We get his POV, which is pretty interesting, and it speaks to his sensitivity to light.
Mm-hmm.
And this vampire is different from your standard lore of, you know, afraid of sunlight vampires, where any light is going to put off, you know, either the old man or this Nosferatu vampire. And so the characters, you know, it's actually Sarah who figures it out pretty quick. And, you know, insists that, you know, they stay in the light at all times. And there's a lot of great play between, like, using the light as a shield.
Yes.
And trying to, like, always maintain something. As the movie goes on and it becomes apparent that, like, Sarah is your badass in this story.
If you are in a horror film, you want her on your team.
Yeah. Yeah. She wasn't dressed the part. It might almost be an aesthetic considering... They knew that the story was going to play out at night. They're like,
wanted to brighten her up. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's keep her in as light a clothes as possible.
Yeah. And they're going to wear some white clothes to go hanging out with a vampire.
So there is a nice poignancy to their relationship, and it becomes all the more tragic as things progress. But I thought it was really strong that even though the shit has hit the fan, life is a mess. Everything's going to be forever ruined. There still is like this inherent tragedy to their relationship being, you know, under this stress. And, you know, I don't want to give spoilers, but you never lose track of these characters you love.
Right.
And I thought like, that's not easy to do. And most movies just kind of say, fuck it. Like once we're in running mode, then we never leave that. And
right.
But this always maintains a certain amount of emotionality.
In some ways, it reminds me of the relationship in Monsters. Because I love the relationship between the two of them in that movie Monsters, and they later go on to get married. But in real life. And this kind of reminded me of that because you see a couple who's funny and self-deprecating and that love each other and all this shit is happening, but they never lose track of who they are, how their relationship is founded, or how their relationship is based between the two of them. And I really love that movie. I think it's so cute. It's like a sad romantic film with vampires.
Based on songs and stories, heroes are renowned, utter passing tales and glories that once was the...
So wrapping up this Irish horror episode, I did want to point out that savehorror.com, friends of ours, Keith and April, who run and do regular reviews of horror movies, you guys should check them out.
Definitely.
Their website and also Facebook and Twitter. This month they are doing a March Madness sort of bracket showdown between your favorite horror movies. So they collect a pool of some of the highest rated horror movies and then they match them up, and the readers, you know, Twitter people, Facebook people, get to vote on their favorites. And the last 2 years in a row, Halloween has won.
Which irritates the shit out of me. I can't even, like, go into that shit.
I don't dislike Halloween, but I think it's a far cry from the best horror movie ever made.
Yes.
So, listeners, please, let's chime in and be heard.
Because we all know it's Fright Night.
So, yes, so check them out on savehorror.com. And download your bracket sheet and get
play
to
along
work.
With us. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely be tweeting as it goes along. That said, we are also online at Rants Macabre on Twitter and Facebook, and also Instagram now. We have an email, therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Is that everything? That's everything.
I think. Yeah, you said about our website.
TheRantsMacabre.com, where we have regular updates to correspond with the podcasts and artwork and contributing content.
And some other music, because Darren has some exciting things coming out. April 1st, is that your album?
That's the date.
How's that going?
I got a lot of work to do still on this this album on the Fangoria Music label. Yeah. Thanks, April of Fangoria Music, for that. I'll talk more about it the closer it comes. And, you know, as my panic wears off.
Once you stop sweating. You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at Fangoria.com.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is... I forgot who I was. And this is Mindy. Thanks.
Slancha.
Time.